This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
And Chris Podgy. Chris Podgy has been teaching 20th century art and theory at Penn since 1987. She holds graduate degrees from the University of Chicago as well as Yale University. Her research and teaching focuses on avant-garde movements and critical debates in 20th century art. She's taught yearly surveys of 20th century art, both graduate and undergraduate seminars on primitivism, on contemporary site-specific and public art, on 20th century theory and criticism, vision and visuality, abstraction, cubism, and the art of the 60s and 70s, to say the least. One book, In Defiance of Painting, Cubism, Futurism, and the Invention of Collage, analyzes Picasso's and Braque's invention of collage and constructed sculpture and their interest in the relation of word and image. A forthcoming book that she's co-edited with Lawrence Rainey and Laura Whitman, due from Yale University Press in 2001, is entitled Futurism, A Reader and Visual Repertoire. And she's particularly interested, as of late, in contemporary performance, installation art, and the work of Robert Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to David and Chris. And they're going to do whatever they want to do, but I have a feeling they're going to maybe talk a little on Osvaldo. And then at that point, when they're ready, maybe Osvaldo will join in, and it'll be more of an interview. And then that'll itself just unfold and open up to the audience. So.
Okay, thanks very much. Do I need this?
It's not amplifying the
music. Oh, it's recording, fine. Okay, well, what I'm going to present to you today is just a few very personal remarks based on my viewing of the hypertext about love, the theater of transparency. And so I don't know how many people have... I'm sorry, I missed that. So great. Well, that's terrific. So these are just some reflections based on my own experience of contemporary art and also, of course, of Picasso's work, which frequently influenced my own point of view. So I was very interested to see how the hypertext was set up, that we open with a notion of transparency, which is very important within 20th century art and really going back to the 19th century, the idea of using transparent materials, of being able to see through something as a kind of metaphor for truth, or some kind of revelation, and how that was then played out in the physical bodies of the puppets who are made out of these transparent materials, but that being undercut by the whole idea of lying and of double identities, of subversive truths which can't be revealed, which you can never be sure about, which sort of undercuts the plot throughout. So the notion of truth, whether there is truth, whether there isn't, and the model of transparency constantly present in the form of these transparent bodies. And simultaneously, the opening line from Picasso, which needless to say caught my attention, which is that love does not exist, only the facts of love exist. So here's a hypertext about love which immediately states that through the voice of Picasso that love does not exist. So we again have this kind of tension between presumption that through transparency, through the title, we're going to get something that we're probably not going to get. The other thing is my own interest in the body and in representations of the body, hybrid bodies, cyborgs, assemblages, new kinds of bodies that are a really great concern to many contemporary artists. And so I was interested to see how this body was presented as a kind of machinic body in a sense, one consisting of parts with a lot of evident ruptures, without really organic transitions. You can see the puppet lines, you can see the strings. So there's that sense that these are merely puppets being directed from without with no internal agency and, of course, with no internal organs. So the irony that you have a body which pants, which groans, which has orgasms, which goes through all of these bodily functions certainly reminded me very much of Marcel Duchamp and his displacement of erotics onto puppet-like, quasi-robotic, mechanomorphic figures onto which one can displace human emotion, always very ironized. And at the same time, because you fight it, they're transparent. That we see that they have no organs. There's no possibility of objection. There's no possibility of blood, guts, spit, anything truly disgusting. It's very anesthetized for me. So I found that to be another kind of tension that the soundtrack would supply a kind of element which simply was not present in the visual material, that you would hear panting and groaning, and then the music would provide a certain emotional content as a supplement, but never constituted within the body as it was given in these machinic bodies. So that relationship was also just very interesting to me, the tension between where's the affect coming from? Well, it's coming from the soundtrack, the little bits of text. It's not in the bodies themselves. At least that was just my reading of it. Then the plot line, of course, was probably the most traditional plot line we've ever seen. It consists of nothing but one cliche after the other. And this is where I think the Balfion model, coming from the analysis of really existing cultural codes that we see in SZ, also immediately came to mind, that we have one cliche after the other, and kind of oscillating from, you know, really cheap dime novels, romantic fiction, all the way to opera. So you have this, you know, quintessential story in which you have, you know, the revelation that the woman is the prostitute, and then desire, you know, confrontations, battles, suicide, all of these highly dramatic, seething emotional elements being played out, but each one so utterly cliched. So that sense that we've seen this all before, and then it imposes a kind of narrative closure. You could predict where this is going to go. Once you see the characters, it gives you a kind of traditional closure, but then that's, for me, it was constantly broken by these references to Picasso, to the little bits of art reference that come in as collages that rupture, that kind of introduce other associations, references to Botticelli that would come in, where a Botticelli figure of the Birth of Venus, very famous image, is torn up and then it's being put back together. But of course you can't believe in that being put back together, since it's so obviously, you know, constructed of a poster or something that's just being there are references to Velázquez, references to Picasso, as I said. You have the high-low, you have the Edith Piaf, and then you have James Brown, and you have so this collision of codes constantly playing out against what we are all very familiar with, this kind of cheap narrative, which at least that's how I took it, a kind of ironic love story with all these cliched elements, but then with these highbrow, you know, elements, the reference to Botticelli, the reference to Picasso, these kinds of things. So, I saw this as just opening up all kinds of lines of inquiry. Do you want to pursue the Picasso line? Do you want to pursue the Duchamp analogy? Do we want to think about Botticelli, the female body? You know, there's possibilities for just branching out in a kind of hypertextual mode. And then finally, just to return to Picasso as the thing that for me, you know, maybe just speaks in the most resonant ways, why Picasso should take the place of being the very first reference that we hear about in the text. And Picasso himself has been fictionalized in many biographies, biographies written by his mistresses. There's an entire discourse about Picasso, which has not done him any great service, I would say, but nonetheless has rendered his life in a similar kind of fiction, where he's been involved in one mistress after the other, tumultuous love affairs, breakups. And, of course, he is also famous for having reordered the human body, and particularly the woman's body, along the lines of desire, having simply deformed, reassembled, put multiple views, and completely felt free to reinvent the body along the lines of desire. So it was interesting to me to then set that as a model of this man whose life as an artist has involved all of this narrative drama and has also had as a parallel the artistic reinvention of the body. So putting those things together, and also, of course, in Picasso's work, the collage element, the disruption, the juxtaposition of image and text. So this was just one of the places that this hypertext sent me as a particular viewer and reader to thinking about. And another line for an art historian would be the Duchamp model, the machines, the sort of cyborgian quality. And so there's just lots of places this could go. And so one thing I really enjoyed about it was the kind of interplay between a coherent, banal, for me at least, storyline, but that nonetheless was sort of casting out feelers and lines in so many different directions. So that's just kind of a personal response.
Thank you. good one. Just that Picasso, you aren't yourself, right? Picasso.
Is that, I was dying to know if I made, there's any...
That's the reason why I put Picasso, because it's talking about Picasso, the macho, Picasso, the one who treats women like this, reinvent the woman, and also because I want to give a historical sense. I want to make it pictorial, because the relation with painting is all my life. I mean, La Daga, as somebody said before, I was thinking of La Daga. And I think, evidently, the prototype of the painter, or Matisse or Picasso. And in the case of love, though Matisse used to have a lot of affairs with the maids and with also natural children, but the quintessence of this kind of activity was Picasso. And so, by saying Picasso, the painter, automatically becomes painter. And also, I don't know, what you say about the figures, the high low, what about the intention. There are other intentions, but you have to know, you know, when I invite Stella to either, once Stella says, what you see is what you see. And I'm against that, of course. The more you know, the more you see. That's my motto. I encourage knowledge, I encourage understanding, because I believe that it's a human condition to be different from a gorilla, which I like a lot. So, I guess that if you know, by example, that the woman who is doing like this, like the new Sendella Scalier from Duchamp, it is somebody who is killing herself. It's Cranach, Lucrezia, because she was raped. So, the more you know in our history, this is my work. I create a kind of system into my work that if you know more, you go more deep, you go more and more. Mm-hmm. I try to make an infiniteness, don't end situation with art, because for me, art is understanding. And I use art didactically. So I was attacked by being didactical. It's one of the things that I'm proud about it. Because if art didactical can change people, and if it can change people, that's what I want. But the more you know, the more you get. That's totally correct. There are other moments trapped doing the thing. The idea of the woman that was trapped herself, of course. She is repairing herself, but also Edith Piaf was a prostitute. If you know that Edith Piaf, how she began to be a great artist, what is France vis-à-vis somebody who's a person who becomes a national myth? I mean, all these things are in my mind, and I put it there. It's not by chance. It's very difficult to see chance. Normally, I design a work to go the most far away you can, because I see myself as a designer of emotions. And this is the place that I look at Duchamp as a great historical transgression and not formal transgression like Picasso. So I like too, but not in the scale of Duchamp. Sorry. No.
Oh. Okay, I'm honored to be here to critique a world international artist and to be on the panel to give my take on it from my own perspective of how what I approach art as an artist and strive to be in terms of the way I try to approach my work. And I'd like to just basically talk about a little of the texts that I read, because, you know, seeing his work, I like to sort of critique his text, because that is, in a way, the way he expresses his art is almost conceptual to me. The way he almost makes it conceptual in terms of the way he describes the way he works. And like, for instance, one of the things that I'm very conscious of is mythologies. And Romberg stated that he believes art is functional and didactic from the viewpoint of the design of the work. I transform the theories of teaching into my artistic credo. I use several rules for the framework of my work on mythology. The chromatic circle, which is very important, because that was a very important part for me, because I'm always looking at the structure of where you start from. I particularly use a grid. And the chromatic circle is one of the ways he used in terms of his starting point. And when I look at the word, it represents color, the relationship of color, the color phenomenon of color, and the color spectrum. Although this is a rigid and neutral framework within which I employ the mythology of color, I strive for the pleasure of doing, which is also what I do, because I'm very intuitive in terms of how I create my work. His position in regard to the theories of education and color is what enables him to prove the mythological foundations. The ideology, he also states, art is a form of mythology. It is where its importance lies. As a mythology, it fills a certain part of the spectrum of explaining the universe and reality. I recycle art history. I force myself to read material, to go through social issues and different times, and enrich the previous concepts that I have about culture and art, and to enlarge my knowledge about history, iconography from all over the world. Each project brings me to another level of self-absorption about culture. Now, when I look at how he applies the word mythology, I see where, when I'm looking at it from a context of the Webster Dictionary, and what Webster says is mythology is the embodiment of ideas and institutions of a society, dealing with gods, demigods, the heroes of a particular people, traditional stories of events that serve to unfold a part of the worldview of that people. So I usually study indigenous cultures. I study the worldview of those indigenous cultures. I study the cosmology of those indigenous cultures. I study the symbologies of those indigenous cultures. I study the patterns and the imagery of those indigenous cultures. So that helps me with trying to bring a contemporary view of those ancient cultures. Now, when he says that his work stems from the chromatic circle, is that in a sense a way of really dissecting a mythology of the worldview? Is that the worldview, the chromatic circle, or is the mythologies of those ancient cultures that you study the mythology that you're trying to obtain and try to bring your take on it? On painting, I agree that painting is a language that proposes numerous possibilities for its reading, which is what Romberg states. Art is a coded language. I also agree on that. Romberg's work makes a didactic use of language, analytical approach in examining the nature of art. I wanted to establish things on the basis of research into the past of painting, history of art. It could be that the coming investigations will be related to magic. Romberg also states that he is an investigator more than an artist, which is very important because before I even touch a painting, I'm constantly researching the culture that I'm trying to interpret in my own way, and I'm also constantly studying what they thought and how they used their symbology functionally as well as didactically. And he also states that my typologies are functional. As an artist, I share many of the philosophies of Romberg. I also believe art should be functional and didactic. I study art forms, symbology, and imagery, and I also believe in the pleasure of creating. I never want to, like Picasso also said, he also said, I never want to know what I'm doing when I start a painting. And I also believe that you should let the intuition, the spirit, use yourself as a vessel. If you study the mythologies of ancient cultures, you will allow yourself to be a vessel, that you will then just intuitively create and work on your work. The colors will come intuitively. The sensations will come intuitively. The sensualization of that particular culture will come in. You will actually become, if I'm painting about Egypt or the Mayan culture, I become that person. I become an Egyptologist. I become that person, so I study it to become and actually live out. And so I'm actually doing everything, thinking, and becoming the embodiment of that particular culture. That's what representing, studying, and really getting into the mythologies means to me. He also does extensive research and extensively studies his subject matter. I also study the history of the modern art. Romberg considers himself a modernist. Now, when I look at the mythologies, again, we stem back to the mythologies, the modernists study ancient indigenous cultures. Picasso, Modigliani, Braque, Matisse, they all studied oceanic art, African sculpture art, and they were also collectors of these indigenous cultures arts. So they, I don't know if they would, I would say that they were people who studied the mythology in the context of these different cultures, but they did study the three-dimensional aspects of them. They did study the indigenous qualities of these cultures, and they also studied the elements of how they incorporate line, design, form, contrast, balance, symmetry, asymmetry, and so forth. So, and I also enjoy that he also studies and gets into the journey of being an artist, and that he is a isolated, introverted person in a sense that he totally gets engulfed in the journey of creating art, and that the creation is the most important thing to him. And he also studies the feminology of art, which means to me, again, when you get back to the mythology, that the study, feminology means to me that the study of the development of human consciousness and the self-awareness as a preface to philosophy. So that also means that that you study the consciousness of these different mythologies, of these different cultures, that you want, or that you're aware of bringing up the development of that, of the human race and the people that look at your work. That's very important to him, that you create a self-awareness that what you get from his work brings more self-awareness to you. Like you said, the more you know, the more it brings to you. Of course, when you have a conscious art crowd, when you do an art show, the better your work will sell, the better your work will look, the more exciting people will be around seeing your work, and the more inspiration they'll get from your work. But if they have no consciousness, then they might as well be looking at this wall. Because consciousness was all that matters, because it is a language. You have to try to decode what he's trying to say. You have to try to understand the didactic approach he's using and the structure that he's using. So all of that's important, the elements that he's using. You don't have to be a critic, or you don't have to be a scholar, but you do have to have some sort of consciousness. And so all of these things that I do agree with him on a lot of things. I just want to get more understanding of what he represents in terms of his mythology, and where's your standpoint in terms of where you start from. Do you start from the 20th century in terms of where the modernists would start from, or do you start from the ancient indigenous cultures in terms of where they would start?
Okay. I will try to address the two or three points to clarify some of the things. Apropos the last question, which is more relevant, socially speaking, the idea from which point of view I refer to this. Of course, this text that you were quoting is from the early 70s, and I'm happy to see after 30 years that I can agree with the text, because I'm totally different. But more or less, I will comply with some of the things you say. 80%. Now, the point of view, what I say in that interview, was very early in the 70s, I only deal with the Western painting from Giotto until today. By the way, the great project I did 7 years was from Pleistoria to Manet. I stopped in Manet for evidently, it's a modernist point of view. Okay. I'm a modernist. I see a modernist, and I think I will dare a modernist. I cannot premonish how I will dare. I believe modernism embodies the spirit of my early years as an artist, and I think we always should be faithful. It's very difficult to transfer completely the spirit of your early years, because even Miles is the greatest American artist of all time. Even Miles, when he plays the last things, Miles still plays the blues. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the rhythm in the back can be multicultural, the rhythm in the back can be fusion, but he plays the blues, is what he belongs to. And I think that I was growing as a young kid with the idea of modernism, of the idea of progress, of the idea that one day we will be like the Europeans, and so on. So this is what pervades all my work. My point of view is absolutely modernist, sure. And I use this system to analyze a phenomenon which, from the point of view of modernism, because if you, I don't want to go very deep into this because it's specific to this conference, but if you can read in these pages of the art history analysis the dualistic purse, how do you say in English dualistic? It's not dualistic, it's dialectic. If you see the dialectic purse, one is a degree of illusion, the other is a degree of innovation. I mean, these kind of purse which I select and invent are a trap, and the trap that I invent is a trap based on modernism. I mean, I believe in innovation because I believe that we are free spirits, and I believe that we are different, and we are one in the world and universe. The only way I can sustain that is by seeing I'm unique. So my point of view has to tend to be unique, which means be alone, be different, which is modernism. Okay. It's to give to the idea of innovation, equality, aesthetic, which is overrated, like in the case of Manzoni, who sells a kind of sheet for in right sheet of an artist. This is a more radical example of the individuality, right? Well, I will commend that at that time he didn't think about it, but I think it's an interesting idea of the thesis that art is a creation, which is my idea.
So this is my point of view. And I don't pretend my point of view. You see, the reason why I don't go to Japan or I don't go to Asia, or I have been in Biennale, but I try to close my eyes, is because I will never understand properly. I don't want to go like a tourist going to see culture. So I refuse the idea to know more. I need to try to see the best I can with what I have in the next year I have, because I hate the idea to go in front of a symbolic fact that this architecture or painting, with this painting, you know, I don't understand nothing. I really look at this with the eyes of a blind, with the eyes of somebody who have not the capacity to cap the symbolic aspect of the artist. And I refuse totally this idea that art should be seen just like tourism. In that sense, I'm an elitist. I believe everybody can have access to art, and we have to facilitate absolutely, totally, democratically. Museums should be free, people have to have right to education. This is 100% my opinion. But if you want gold, you have to earn it. You have to go and fight and look and read and become an artist, which is a painful journey for years and years, which is part of your biography, of your genetics, and of your environment. And of course, it's not the same environment to be in Angola than to be in Paris and in Buenos Aires. And that's why there's a different point of view, which I welcome. But my point of view is modernist, yes. And my focus is in what I was grown, which is the West culture, okay, and the West values. So for me, it's very difficult to claim, like many of my colleagues, to be a multiculturalist and this and this. I believe this is bold, because they are not prepared to confront a real multiculturalist world. I know how much I don't know enough about Bolivia. My country, where I was born, is near Bolivia. Yeah, I know the Valsecitos and the Peruanitos. This is not to know Bolivia. When you go to teach in the northern of Argentina, Indians, as I was teaching in the late period I was living in Argentina, then you realize Argentina is not Buenos Aires. And then you realize this is Latin America, and Buenos Aires is not Latin America. That's why I really don't want to pretend that my system is universal, that my values that I apply can be good for all kinds of cultures. Not at all. The chromatic silk, which you mentioned as mythology, let me try that because people get trapped in there. The reason why I threw a chromatic silk is because it's an order which is established. I see, if you go any place you begin from yellow, if you go to this side, to the blue, you will get the green in the middle. I want to have something which is not subject to subjectivity in the way I make a painting. So, because it's not subjectivity in my point of view. And if you put subjectivity plus subjectivity plus subjectivity, you will get crazy and you make people crazy. So, in a way, what I was trying to do is to establish a system, and when I make a painting, I do the order of the chromatic circle, because everybody knows the chromatic circle, and everybody knows that the three basic is supposed to deal with something that is basic, like to say, 2 plus 2 is 4. So, I can teach only when I can submit complex values to simple values that you know already. And that was a chromatic circle, was a mythology which was easy to understand. But not because I believe there's aesthetic quality in the chromatic circle. It was just a way to go to somebody, common knowledge.
Thank you.
I wanted to just start the question and answer at this point, and we're just going to ask that everybody speak as loudly as possible, and if possible for the panelists to repeat or rephrase the question in case it doesn't come out in the recording.
Yes, as we go.
My question is coming from what David was saying. As I've been looking through your work as well, though, I've been really interested in how the symbols and the mythologies operate in your art, because you have, to me, I see sort of a mystical, almost a supernatural infusion of spirit into your work, but at the same time, I feel like there's a kind of potential duality between that and the work of the art historian, collector, almost creating a museum through the work, through history. So what David, I thought, brought up well was, where do the symbols stop? Do you want to bring magic back through the paintings out to us, or are we merely regarding the ancient cultures and ideologies as a collection of objects?
Well, I wish I can answer so easy. The work here, I mean, this morning have been many things touching point of my work. And what is interesting is to see somebody speak about you in terms that you never saw before. You know? Because that's what I will take it immediately and say, yes, I want it. Sure. Always, if it's good, you have to say, yes, I want it. And the taxonomy is true. I don't know what is the guy who talked about the transponder. It was a really beautiful, beautiful point of view. Yeah, I was influenced by Levi Strauss at that time, which I eventually met years later in Israel. But my work is not intellectual. My work comes, first of all, for my curiosity. I begin with curiosity. So when I did the project from Prehistoria to Manet, which is the more apparently intellectual. By the way, when you are looking at what you look in the beginning, who look like a samples of color to sell paint, that was the way that they classified my work in the 70s in the newspaper. They used to make mockery of my work, saying that I do the catalog for the companies of color, which I always found beautiful. The truth is that the story doesn't begin with analytical situation or Levi Strauss. The truth is that I immigrated from Argentina. I have to go away from the political situation who was killing my students and who was repugnant from the fascism point of view for years before. Okay? The deception of Argentina has been terrible politically from the humanistic point of view. So one moment you have to go. When I immigrate to Israel, I go to a place of people didn't know that I was already, I mean, they know, but they ignore that, of course, because they are the newcomer. And I was trained like a beginner when I already was a national award in Argentina at 30 years old, and I was 35 when I immigrated. So I was really in a very difficult state. I was only recognized as a teacher because I have publication immediately. The architectural school, the art school, gave me a job, and I begin, after the war, I have some time I work as a carpenter. But anyway, then the war finished in 73, I become a professor. But the truth is that in the art world, and also I think that the fact that I moved to another country and I lost all my market, all my critics, all my friends, put me in a very good situation. Immigration is fantastic. Immigration is a metaphor in poetics, because I think that a metaphor is the immigration of the meaning. I don't know if it's correct, but that is my imagination. When you create a metaphor, the meaning goes to another sentence. And for me, going to Israel was to begin again. And to come to America, this is another moment I change again. Because my art became more radical. And the problem was that I want to paint, I didn't know what to paint. This is the reality. I didn't have a studio, so I have called, I need to paint physically. I'm a person who is not an intellectual, again. An intellectual can sublimate things, I cannot. So I begin to paint, and I didn't know what to paint. So I begin to make just marks with colors, different colors, put the names. This is the reality. It was nothing theoretical. And I began to push things in the wall. The name was full of marks with the names. And then I did, what I do, what I want, I do a series, like in music. So I said, okay, let's do the gravation of course. This is the reality. So I put it in the wall. And you know what I found interesting? I say, why Lichtenstein can make comics big size and I cannot make color classifications in big size? And I begin to understand, that was a sentence I said at that time, 1970, classification is beautiful, as a modus operandi. And then in 1974 I went to London for a group show of Latin American art, and the curator, who was the actual director of the museum in Buenos Aires, brought work that I was doing before in Buenos Aires with the classification of landscape, and I brought my new work from Israel, because I need Argentinians there. So I put my work in the collection, no, that's not good, didn't put the seat with brought from Buenos Aires, so I put it on the floor. That's because you need some love, and when people love you, you feel encouraged to do more, if you're young. And so what happened is, I hope you get it, what happened is that the director of the ICA in London passed by the gallery and see the work on the floor. And say, who did that? And you go, I did that. I say, it's marvelous. So the other looks very Argentina. And he said, you know what? It's on paper here. I have entered the gallery. I give you a one-man show. And I got a one-man show in 74 in the Institute of Contemporary Art. That began my career in Europe, because then some visitors from Belgium and Paris to the ICA, they look at the room that I have a one-man show. They invite me the next year, floor deck to the PCC in Antwerpen. And then begins all the idea. And then, which was totally intuitive, I meet Florbeck, who remind me to Buren, Daniel Buren. So, you know the group Support Surfaz? I didn't know Support Surfaz at all. I come from Argentina, go to Israel. He goes, no. He said, you know Cahiers de Peinture? No. So you should meet them. So he made me the contact with Daniel Buren, in which we become friendly, and with Toroni, which was doing, by the way, Coup de Pinceau, very close to what I was doing with another spirit. And then, nevertheless, I was very avant-garde. I was doing exactly what they were trying to do with Paris. But it was by chance. It was because, now, it's not by chance, because I study architecture, I teach color in the second year as an assistant. So there was this idea of the Bauhaus. My teacher, Breyer, which I said before, was an architect, and Mike Cranning was an architect. So this idea of chromatism or organizing is not from itself, but this is mainly as it comes. And it's not based on a theoretical idea. So immediately, after I meet Bourin, and then I meet Plenet, and I first read the writings of Plenet, and when my dealer in Paris asked me who I want you to meet, I say Plenet, and of course I meet Plenet, we make a great acquaintance, and he wrote the bouquin about my work, and so, and Roland Barthes was brought by Plenet and Bernard Javet, all the group of Telquel. But this is the way it happened. It's not what that I really planned to do, this kind of work. This kind of work was because I was very worried, didn't know what to do. And then the second thing, why I did art history? The director of the ACSA, who invited me to do the show, wanted me to do a painting on Rubens for the Museum of Modern Art. So I go to the cathedral, I see the painting, no way, I don't like Rubens. I don't like that Rubens. So they take me to all the Rubens, and all the cathedrals and all the churches in Antwerp, no way, no, I don't like, I don't do it. And then they took me to a bank, Lambert, La Banque Lambert, and they have the most beautiful Rubens you can imagine. They have the real Rubens, the one he painted. And I love them. It's true. Rubens didn't paint, they didn't paint. And I love it. And I love it, and they give me a catalog. So in the night, in the hotel, I begin to study. I did pencil lines. And I begin to study how to do a big painting because I wanted the money, because they wanted to tell me to do a painting for the museum. And I begin to classify the color for me. And I realized that for the reproduction in the middle, the color system, analysis of value, and the text was not mine, was the text writing. And then I say, hey, if I put on the right side the color, on the left side the values, and then my comments, this has to do with my analysis of color. And then I say, but what am I going to write? I have to write what? So I think phylogenetic, I have to write where is it coming from, and then how I see this. And that was the way I invented that. What was the consequence of chance? Mm. And that's why I tell you again, I think that always, how much you can be intellectual or programmed artist, it's a pendulum in the world. I always begin to do projects in my studio, my students know that, and I always go to another side in there, because I'm prepared to change in the process of working.
Can I follow that? It's wonderful to hear you talk. I also want to engage everyone with
sure.
you. Now, one way to spur that on is, given that you've spoken with us in terms of an imaginary audience that you haven't had for years, except in your mind, and now is actually sitting before you, do you have questions for us as your imaginary audience now realizes?
Yeah, I mean, I would like to hear, sure, how each one, this is, I guess, mainly people who know my work because we're students of mine, people who are students in university, right? And I want to know, yes, I would like to know how they feel vis-a-vis a work of art, at least because it's shown in art museums, which is not going according to the traditional thing that art should be something that you look and you get an orgasm or something very emotional. I would like to hear, of course, from the public the remarks. And also I would like my friend here to say something about the work.
Well, I sense that last remark has something to do with a critique of the sensationalism in 90s art, and part of the reason that I focused on my response to Oswaldo's work, what is 8 years ago, is that most of my time now is spent kind of being what Oswaldo said, being a tourist of spectacle. I like spectacle as good as the next guy. I know the whole critique of spectacle. I actually am kind of on the side that some spectacle is good. I loved the Damien Hirst show in New York. I saw it 7 times, so I guess I loved it. But I think this is what Oswaldo is referring to. It's created a different whole level of work. I don't know. I want to talk a little bit about the video that we saw. I saw Osvaldo's show was up when? With that
October.
In October, which was unfortunately Damien Hirst month in New York. And well, this is what I'm getting to. I saw it on a Saturday afternoon when I had just come from Lady Gagosian Gallery, where there must have been a couple thousand people in the gallery. It was like Times Square of art. It was something that I don't think there's been three or four moments like that in the 20 years I've been writing about art in New York. It just was one of those bewildering and strange moments where spectacle was the operating force and people were just in awe of it. As I was. I mean, I'm not going to be overly critical about it because there's some things in her work that I really like. And then I went over to Osvaldo's exhibition where there were about six people in the gallery, which is the more usual audience that I see art, kind of quiet context. But what that video does show is it was part of an installation. Was this conceived as an entire installation? It was in a dark gallery. Chairs were lined up in front of the screen. And then in nooks, it's kind of a strange, not quite basement, but a Chelsea raw space, which was kept raw. It wasn't just totally a white box like most of the Chelsea spaces are. And there were little nooks and crannies, and Osvaldo did all kinds of fascinating things with more of these figures and spotlights in, you know, up on the walls and on platforms and down in, there's a little hole in the wall. And the video was playing as part of that. Now, having come from the high, the high of Damien Hirst's symbolism and Excalibur, I don't know if you saw the show, but he had about science, it's about death, it's about gore, it's beautiful fish tanks. The video plays a much less, it seemed melancholy. In the installation. It almost seemed like the installation was like a cabaret which had run out of energy or something. Not energy. You know what I'm saying? A cabaret where the it wasn't the cabaret. I don't know what I'm trying to say. Let me talk about the two figures who are making love and then to the Edith Piaf song. The figures are something that's developed in Osvaldo's work in the last 5 years. And I kind of vision them, since the plastic material was the material of the enclosures and was the material of the cage and everything, and for me kind of symbolized one's posture kind of up there in the realm of sort of copies and real, the museum, world capitals, art and everything. It kind of symbolized a figure coming down out of art into real life. And they've been very puppet-like. I think this was the first video version.
You saw it before?
I saw the puppet version. Anyway, they seem to be more stuck in the real world. They seem a little bit less optimistic. All the optimism which I expressed in my formal presentation here seems to be troubled at the moment. Now this corresponds to a lot that's going on in American video art right now in a lot of different ways. There's a lot of young artists who are choosing not to use real human beings, but to use toys and puppets and different things. And you have to want, it's just a whole fetishistic thing. And it's kind of a less engaged response to reality. It's been critiqued in that manner. I don't know if Osvaldo was dealing with a fact that there's a little bit less ability in American art right now to get up to the level of whatever Damien Hirst is doing. It just seemed to be conflicted and dealing with a less optimistic, certainly unsensational, it's like an anti-sensational situation, which I just felt like it just felt like Damien Hirst time, and it just was like, at the moment, the good guys are losing. That's what it felt like. At the moment, the unsensational, the people who are for unsensational, quote, serious art, are not having their way right now. Yes.
Okay. Well, in response to some of what you were saying, and in response to the transparent figures, McKim was saying before about the narrative that was going on between the two figures. It seems to me somewhat like you just said that they seem to be more embodiments of larger meta narratives than they are actual characters to me. And you're talking about the sort of distancing artists use other puppets or monsters or whatever. It seems to me that they help critique the constructive nature of personal narratives, and especially personal narratives of the artist, like for instance, David Hirst's character, a character that is constructed carefully based on a coherent body of work, you know, et cetera, that the persona. And it sounds like, for instance, the problem Kasha spoke of you, I'm getting it right, there's no love, but there's only the facts of love, but there's also, it's similar to there's only the story of love as well. And it seems to me that's sort of with a move on your part, I'm not sure if that's correct, but to be self-conscious of your own narrative as an artist. I'm wondering where you, if that relates to what you're saying at all, or to what you were doing.
It relates to my life, my work, evidently. I was working with somebody not Argentinian or Uruguayan, and we do this kind of work. But what I should say, probably in front of you, is that this is the first step of a trilogy, which I'm planning, and I think I'm going to do. I'm in the second part now, trying to get the money to do it in a ballet. The first is an opera, so to speak, or the kind of sort of opera, about this mystification of love, romantic love, or the love that it is from the Bible until today, because we are in a mutation, evidently, of love. And my second work, which is going to be the ballet called Patatus, is going to deal exactly with the mutation. And it's with music of Miles Davis, which is blue, combined with electronic music, the hybrid, 15 minutes, which I deal with this mutation. And I'm working already in the photographs and the test of this thing. And the third is going to be an oratorio, which I want is the opera, the ballet, and the oratorio, in which I'm going to work with the idea of premonition. So, and then I will do a book with that. And this is a project will take me in the next 5 years, probably. Though it's difficult to see this without the context of the complete project. But evidently, I agree with you that it's absolutely. And also, I was so happy with your mention of Kish, because I don't want to talk about your work of Kish because it's a colleague and I don't speak about colleagues only with my students and the artists. But the fact that I want to emphasize is that there was this kind of enormous. I think that the show of Kish cost $3 million, $2 million. And I did my show with my students, and we said I'm doing the clothes and the rooms and some of the people who are here. We see, okay? And everything was done in my studio, the animation with my assistants and everything. And one of the things I think is important is that we should do culture with low budget. Because it's the only way we have to fight against the $3 million, which who knows where are coming from. I really mean that, because there are rumors that some of the galleries work quite in money from the mafia, and not by chance. Of course. So, I say that the more you can reduce the cost of creating art and education, the more it's possible to do education for a lot of people and to create art for a lot of people. I am absolutely for a strategic reason, not because I believe morally that this is good or bad, that we should do art which is easy to produce, easy to transport, and can reach the most you can. Yes, sorry.
Sorry, this is precisely my point with what you're talking about. You sort of set up almost a diametric opposition of intention between the first show and Osvaldo's section or show. And someone else mentioned post-capitalism here. I don't want to, you know, get down into a political program, but it seems like that's what I was kind of trying to get at without actually saying it, was the role of this sort of artist as sellable character, or
I'm sorry,
an artist as saleable character, or I'm sorry, artist as a a character that you're constructing for yourself or a narrative as an artistic persona that is inherently sellable. I think that's one of the things that I see. I mean, maybe I'm reading into it, but I see that you making being self-conscious of and critiquing.
I think the construction. You construct
and its relationship to the market as well.
To the market and to the seeds, of course. Not to the market, but to the media. Of course. And this is what Duchamp teaches so well. It's that. Because you see, when I come back to my painting late here, 2 years or 3 years ago, I begin to paint again. And I don't. Now I'm painting less because I'm a little bored already. But the reason why I begin to paint myself. It was because of strategy, because I thought it was necessary for the idea of the mediatization to create a work which, from a strategic point of view, have the value of the craft. Otherwise, I don't see any reason why to paint, if it's not for that quality. I wanted to give that touch of aura at that moment, now and again, for another reason. But it's always, this has to be moving. It's a kind of cultural opportunism that you have to have vis-a-vis in order to be combatant. It's like a militia. You don't attack the town in front, you attack from the side. You have to maybe use bottles, sometimes you use. I mean, just that, this is a war.
Okay.
But you work according to a strategy. Your death is your emotions come on expected.
My emotion is my work.
What?
My emotion is my work.
Well, I found.
Well, because you see, and there's a problem always that most of the students, they tend to express themselves. And you see, you express yourself when you become what you are going to do. I mean, it's too much expression in our work. And I think it's a little complicated. Leonardo didn't express himself so much, not Raphael, not Rembrandt. They express automatically. I think that we have an attack on the idea of expression, which is a very easy way to sell art. And it's a very easy way to involve in art. Because nobody can really, you see, all this talk about, well, I don't want to go into lecture, because the question will take me to explain myself, but in fact, just to answer, the expression is in the subject matter, you said, in the code. The real meaning of the work of art is in the code, not in the subject matter, in my opinion. The subject matter, anybody can touch. I'm sorry, this is a very radical statement, but this is what I think. Yeah. Why don't you say what you want to say, not to me. I want you to say it.
But it just seems to me that in all your work that I've seen, including the video and the work of the Renaissance masters with their various working of that, reworking of, you know, their position of forms and color on it, and what we saw of the Rubens with. Yeah, all those different things have several different, very almost, it would seem as if it was almost contradictory, but I don't think it is, but a number of different complicated aspects to them, all of them have that. And it's partly very analytical, it's partly very Brechtian in the sense of pushing you back to make you think about it. And it's partly, and it's also very sensual. They're all sensual.
Wonderful. This kind of perfect.
Maybe one question relating to what Chris was saying and what to your answer as well. I was very pleased to hear that you claimed you were a modernist. And at the same time, you said that your system was not universal. And it's not that I see a real contradiction, but my question would be, how do you limit the universality that is often ascribed to the modernism of, let's say, Le Corbusier or high modernism in the architectural mode that is often these days debunked or attacked for being too universal?
The problem is, it's difficult for an European. We are in a similar situation a half year ago with Cantu. Argentina. I see a lot of things that I didn't know what I'm going to say, but Mauricio Cacca, by the way, we know each other by admiration for 20 years. We are going to do work together because we are corresponding, and he has all my Cacca. And as soon as we can meet together in Cologne, some place we are going to do a work. there is some to, I think, the government is supposed to be universal, but the structure is supposed to, but Argentina always have this best conscience of being universal, because, you know, the fault. And so, even if you take something like that, right, which is so universal that it's important to this time, but how can you say universal? To two gauchos who are feeling his nation speaking, how was the matter? Hey, what's the little court? And then they begin trrr. So this always, this, I think that the postmodern reason doesn't exist, the Cristo Rey in Argentina. And the Cristo Rey for long years in Latin America, in the periphery. Because when we apply the values of the modernism from the point of view from Argentina, I quit Argentina when I was 30, 30 something, you can never be totally universal. You still have, in some way, to have this anti-capitalist, anti-center situation in which you refuse to be totally a modernist in an orthodox way. Mm-hmm. In the other hand, we read all the literature, we read all the things which are, of course, universal. I don't think one of the books who really was a transition for me was Thomas Kuhn, The Age of the Paradigm. By the way, if you look at the work that we can talk this afternoon, this is a change, not a change of paradigm. My work made a switch, very radical, from very analytical and very theoretical, apparently, or involved with issues of work theoretical, to some work which are absolutely more central in the last, from my I feel like that was a switch that come from my lab when my son David was born. When my son David was born, I began to pay to Valise. Nobody knows his painting, but I never showed it. I have a piece of 3 years, but I don't want to show it yet, but I have to paint. I did a lot of surrealist painting. And I think that there are things that life brings to the world, which are from life. And this is not because they're more authentic or more important than the other, because you can bring from life things that are so stupid sometimes. But it's a fact that your life is not totally controlled by your mind, but also by your emotions. This is the place of emotions, and what emotions influence your mind. Okay.
Okay, I think we're going to break here. You've all been very patient. I would want to have lunch for you in just a minute. So we're going to have about a half hour. Lunch is almost set up in the hall, so you can feel free to move out there. And then we'll be back in the afternoon with panel to more work. And give yourselves and panels and us all know again for being a great audience.